It's 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama weighs in on Egypt's ceasefire proposal. And Good Luck Jonathan is chastised by a 17-year-old Pakistani girl. I'm Terry Wing, reporting from Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is convening his security cabinet today to consider an Egyptian proposed ceasefire with Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip. Ahead of the meeting, the armed wing of Hamas rejected the plan, saying it would amount to surrender. The proposal calls for a temporary ceasefire to go into effect immediately, followed by talks between the two sides in Cairo. U.S. President Barack Obama said late Monday at a dinner celebrating the Muslim holy month of Ramadan that he was encouraged by Egypt's proposal and that further escalation benefits no one.
I will say very clearly, no country can accept rockets fired indiscriminately at citizens. And so we've been very clear that Israel has the right to defend itself against what I consider to be inexcusable attacks from Hamas. At the same time, on top of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza that we've worked long and hard to alleviate, the death and injury of Palestinian civilians is a tragedy, which is why we've emphasized the need to protect civilians, regardless of who they are or where they live.
The potential ceasefire comes a week after Israel launched an offensive in response to what it said was weeks of heavy rocket fire out of Hamas-ruled Gaza. For more on President Obama's comments, visit our website at voanews.com. A senior UN official warns the growing Syrian refugee crisis in Lebanon could explode into intersectarian violence. The official says competition between the Lebanese and Syrians for limited resources is increasing tensions between these communities to a dangerous level. Here's Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Lebanon has the highest proportion of refugees of any country in the world. The UN Refugee Agency has registered more than 1.1 million Syrian refugees, and those numbers are going up by 12,000 a week. It is estimated the refugee population will reach 1.5 million by the end of the year. UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Lebanon, Ross Mountain, says refugees now comprise one quarter of Lebanon's population, and this is rising to one third. Lebanon has no refugee camps, so most of the Syrian refugees live in some 240 of Lebanon's poorest communities in the northern Akkar and Bekaa regions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pakistani schoolgirl Malala Yousafzai on Monday called on Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan to meet the parents of the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram 3 months ago. Malala said she hopes her presence in Nigeria will place more pressure on the government to free the girls.
I spoke to him about those girls whom I met yesterday and who were telling me that they cannot go to school. They have dreams. They want to become doctors, engineers, and teachers. But the government is not providing them any facility. They also need health facilities. They also need security, but the government is not doing anything.
Malala, who turned 17 this week, has become a symbol for women's rights after being shot by the Taliban in Pakistan for defending her right to an education. The United States says Iran is negotiating in a serious manner over its nuclear development program, but it also says any agreement is likely to come after a Sunday deadline. Negotiations in Vienna between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif are still reported far apart on key issues. Senior officials at the meeting say the size of Iran's future enrichment program remains a question. Also, they say Iran has yet to convince the United States it is not trying to develop nuclear weapons. Somalia has posted its first ambassador to the United States since the East African government collapsed more than 20 years ago. Omar Abdi Rashid Sharmark met with U.S. President Barack Obama Monday at the White House. Sharmark told VOA that the development is a monumental step for Somalia. He said it shows that Somalia wants to deepen its relationship with the United States. And the United Nations said Monday it is temporarily withdrawing its staff from Libya because of the deteriorating security situation there. That's the latest world news from the VOA newsroom in Washington. I'm Terry Wing reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Pakistani TH education campaigner Malala Yousafzai urges Nigeria's president to meet with kidnapped girls' parents.
I consider those girls as my sisters. They are my sisters, and I'm going to speak up for them until they are released.
Ugandan children provide a fresh perspective on climate change. We remember anti-apartheid activist and Nobel Prize-winning writer Nadine Gordimer. They are debating the death penalty in Zimbabwe, and a Zambian opposition leader is skeptical about President Michael Sata's health.
What I can say is that even a child in the street does not understand why we have not seen the president in person. We are not saying the president is sick and dying. All we are saying is that this thing does not make sense.
Father Frank Bualia is a former Catholic priest and a Zambian opposition leader. And Somalia appoints its first ambassador to the United States since 1991. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. On a visit to Abuja, Nigeria, the Pakistani schoolgirl and education campaigner Malala Yousafzai has called on the Nigerian president to meet with the parents of the schoolgirls abducted by the Islamist terror group Boko Haram. More than 200 girls are being held in the northeast of the country, where Boko Haram is waging an insurgency against government forces. Henry Richwell reports for VOA from London.
Malala Yousafzai survived a murder attempt by the Taliban when she was a schoolgirl in Pakistan. In the 2 years since, she has become a globally recognized campaigner for access to education. Meeting President Goodluck Jonathan, she urged Nigeria and the international community to step up efforts to free the girls kidnapped by Boko Haram.
And I'm hopeful that the international community would also consider it really important and they would take serious action. Because if we think that this country is far away in Africa and it's not going to affect other countries, we're really wrong.
It has been 3 months since the girls' abduction from Chibok in northeast Nigeria. The government says it knows where they are and is working on their release, insisting the details are too sensitive to release. The parents say the lack of information adds to the pain. After meeting some of them Sunday, Malala pledged to keep working for the girls' release.
I consider those girls as my sisters. They are my sisters, and I'm going to speak up for them until they are released.
The name Boko Haram translates as Western education is a sin. In a video posted online Monday, the group's leader, Abubakar Shekau, repeated his demand that Boko Haram prisoners be released in exchange for the girls. Shekau said Nigerians are saying bring back our girls, but he says we are telling President Goodluck Jonathan to bring back our arrested warriors, our army, bring back our army. Nigeria has engaged in prisoner exchanges with Boko Haram in the past, but the group is now much stronger, says Elizabeth Donnelly of policy group Chatham House, who spoke to VOA on the phone from Nigeria.
You're dealing with a much more confident and lethal group, and it's certainly a far, far worse relationship in terms of trust and confidence between the government and the group. And not forgetting also that as we approach elections in 2015, matters related to Boko Haram and anything around how this particular moment of the crisis is managed is becoming increasingly politicized.
Malala Yousafzai turned 17 Monday. She said her birthday wish was to bring back our girls now and alive. The parents warmly welcome efforts to raise awareness. They are desperate for information on their daughters. Henry Richwell for VOA News, London.
Zambia's government on Monday released photographs showing President Michael Sata chairing a cabinet meeting following opposition criticism that the administration has been hiding the president's alleged deteriorating health condition. Mr. Sata recently visited Israel, where he is alleged to have sought medical attention for an undisclosed ailment. Opposition leader Father Frank Bualia, a former Catholic priest, tells reporter Peter Clotty that there is need for the government to tell Zambians the truth about the president's health condition.
Well, what I must say is that it is very sad that leaders in Africa, once they are given power, they think that the rest of the country have become blind and therefore they begin to do things that a normal person will consider as highly insulting to the general citizenry. This is what is happening in our country. The president introduced a habit of inviting the media into cabinet meetings, and then he would shout at his ministers, and the media would be allowed to splash all this show and so on. Why they are failing to do the same now, when it is the president himself who, for the first time in the history of our country, introduced this culture, we can't understand.
Are you therefore saying that the picture purportedly showing President Sata chairing a cabinet meeting in good health condition is just a manipulation of the media? Is that what you're referring to?
What I can say is that even a child in the street does not understand why we have not seen the president in person. And the pictures that they have used are still pictures. We are not saying the president is sick and dying. All we are saying is that this thing does not make sense. The president went around the country to canvass for what people voted for him. Now that there are these rumors, some people have been saying he has died. If the onus is on him to come out in the public and say he's well. And this is not well, the people understand. Why all these facts, all these points to bad leadership? And as I was trying to say, it's a blessing in disguise that this has come this year when we are celebrating our golden independence jubilee, so that Zambians can realize that the people have been governing us from before independence. They don't fit in the current dispensation. And this should be the last time Zambians are voting for this kind of people.
But Father Bwalya, some supporters of the president are saying that the opposition, including you, appear to be wishing the president ill will, and they say that is not acceptable.
No one in the world died because somebody wished them dead. People die because their time to die has come. So if the opposition are wishing the president ill and the ones they are wishing him dead, why should they worry when the president is doing the right thing? Why should anyone worry? After all, as I said, no one would die just because people are wishing them dead. These people are failed to govern, and they know that in this part of the world, if you accuse somebody of wishing another person dead, that amounts to witchcraft. And people would look down upon such a person. They may even, instill instant justice on them and kill them. If you say I'm wishing somebody dead, it means that I'm a wizard.
Father Frank Bwalya is a former Catholic priest and a Zambian opposition leader. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. The death penalty is a divisive issue in Zimbabwe, as is elsewhere. Despite calls to abolish it by human rights groups, the country's high court recently sentenced three police officers and a civilian to death by hanging. However, as Blessing Zulu reports, a meeting in Cotonou, Benin this week shows momentum is building against capital punishment worldwide.
Debate over capital punishment was reignited in Zimbabwe by two high-profile court cases. The first, the High Court's decision to sentence to death three policemen and a civilian who murdered a security guard during a botched armed robbery 4 years ago. The second, the Supreme Court's quashing of the death penalty on a game ranger by the High Court. The Supreme Court argued that the High Court had misled itself as it had ignored extenuating circumstances. The decision by Zimbabwe's courts paradoxically coincides with the African Union's African Commission on Human and People's Rights call for the abolishment of the practice, human rights lawyer Arnold Tsunga, an opposition movement for democratic change legislator who attended the Benin meeting, says he supports the call for a moratorium.
Zimbabwe, Botswana, Somalia, Sudan, those are the countries that are still implementing the death penalty in Africa, but the movement is towards abolishing.
The conference organized by the Benin government, the AU's Human Rights Commission, and death penalty opponents like Hands Off Cain is among the growing voices against the practice. Organizers hope to increase support among African countries ahead of a new resolution for a universal moratorium on executions at the next AU General Assembly meeting and the adoption of an additional African protocol for the abolition of the death penalty. Tsunga says he is pleased that 19 out of 54 countries in Africa have de facto moratorium on the death penalty, and he says the death penalty does not deter people murdering others.
There's been a lot of research that has been done globally that in all those countries where the death penalty has been abolished, you don't see an increase in serious crime. At the same time, in all those countries where the death penalty is implemented, you also do not see a reduction in crime.
Zimbabwe's constitution allows for the death penalty, but no one has been executed since 2004, in part because no one was willing to take up the job. Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa, who was once sentenced to death by the rebel government of Ian Smith, has vowed not to sign any execution warrants.
We have 89 people on the death row. Two of them are women, and they are lucky to have signed papers for their execution.
Meanwhile, men on death row, such as convicted murderer Shepherd Mazango, who robbed and hugged a man to death, have raised constitutional arguments in a Supreme Court challenge against the death penalty. Reporting for VOA Studio 7 for Zimbabwe, this is Blessing Zulu in Washington.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 15th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Somalia has appointed its first ambassador to Washington since the collapse of the state in 1991. The new ambassador is Omar Abdelrashid Shamaki, who served as prime minister in 2009 and 2010. He met with President Barack Obama Monday at the White House. Mr. Shamaki told Harun Maruf of VOA Somalia Service that Somalia wants to deepen its relations with the United States.
Really, it was a monumental step for Somalia to really present its credentials to the President of the United States, to President Barack Obama. And so I think it was an historic day for Somalia and the United States to really deepen the already existing relations and the friendship, and to cooperate closely on the common agenda, the common interest two countries share.
And what's the significance of your appointment here now?
My appointment actually signifies the importance in which Somalia sees the relations and the friendship of the United States. I think the president actually selected me for the purpose of showing that Somalia really cares and wants to deepen its relation with the United States.
And what are your priorities?
You know, the priorities of the country is really to first establish a good relationship with the United States and then work on what is going to be our common agenda and our common interest. That will have a lot of issues. I think today I might not discuss policy issues here, but as we go along, we're definitely going to explain what are the policy objectives of Somalia in my coming here in the United States.
And tell me about your conversations with President Obama. What did he tell you about the United States government's priorities with regard to Somalia?
Really, most of the discussion was in the importance of reestablishing Somalia's presence and diplomatic in core in America, and how the United States really now is aiming at strengthening relations with Somalia at this juncture.
How are you going to start work? I understand Somalia sold its embassy building in Washington. Where are you going to start things from?
You know, it's going to be very challenging, but definitely we're going to lease an office as soon as we get a space, and definitely get a rent residence for an ambassador. And then from there on, also build a team, very competent team, it will work in strengthening and advancing the relationship between the United States and Somalia.
Omar Abdelrashid Shamaki is Somalia's new ambassador to the United States. He spoke with Harun Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. Last weekend, Uganda hosted the first Children's Climate Change Conference, where hundreds of young delegates shared their ideas on how to tackle a growing global problem. Hilary Hewler has more for VOA from Kampala.
11-year-old Neola Taka is pretty sure that sooner or later, her life is going to be affected by climate change.
I think that most people around would not be able to get enough food. The drought would be high and be forced to migrate. But also I would think that the lifestyle of people would change. Like if you have been having enough water to drink, you'll not be able to. You have to walk long distances.
Last Saturday, Taka and her classmates presented their thoughts on climate change to an audience of their peers. This was the International Children's Climate Change Conference in Kampala, Uganda, reportedly the first of its kind. The conference was organized by Joseph Masembe, who runs a local organization called Little Hands Go Green. He says he was looking for a way to make the concept of climate change relevant to ordinary Ugandans. an idea he got 2 years ago while attending the UN climate change conference in Doha.
And when I sat there, it was greenhouse gas emissions, and these people haven't ratified the Kyoto Protocol and the Bali conference, and on and on and on. But I looked at the average Ugandan. I thought, what can they do? Let's get the simple aspects of it. Let me create a climate change conference that is hinged around children.
More than 200 children came from schools around Uganda, including international schools. Masembe says 35 nationalities were represented. Each school gave a presentation on how Ugandans can help tackle the global crisis.
Some of your vehicles, when you're driving around town, the vehicle is just producing only dangerous gases, and it can't stop producing them. So I would advise you to discourage movement by vehicles over short distances.
Masembe says he was impressed by what they had to say.
I am actually shocked at where these children got all these ideas, because we do not have environmental conservation education in the national curriculum. It is not there at all, because you see, we are naturally endowed. So we don't realize that we are losing out on our vegetation cover. We believe it is there. We are the Pearl of Africa, and people just wake up and live like that.
But he says the effects of climate change are already being felt. Young delegates like 10-year-old Patricia Gukina were not impressed with how adults have been handling the environment.
I think they don't take into practice what they say. They tell us to plant trees, but they don't. Do as I say, but not as I do.
Taka hopes that even though they're still kids, her generation can change that. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
South African writer and Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer has died in her Johannesburg home at the age of 90. Gordimer was an anti-apartheid activist whose writings helped to expose South Africa's white minority rule government to a global readership. Libby Mitchell is head of the School of Languages and Literature at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. She describes Gordimer as a woman of principle. Mitchell tells me that as an early member of the African National Congress, Gordimer believed that even if she did not agree with everything the ANC stood for, she wanted to join it to make it a better organization.
She's a very feisty person, you know, a woman of principle. And she's always been an activist, aside from being a literary person. So she's always shown tremendous strength of character, sort of an indomitable spirit, you know.
She also played a role at her writings in the anti-apartheid movement. I was reading also that the late Nelson Mandela used to read her work.
Yes, that's right. All her work had political themes always. She's always, you know, had great concerns around the issues of apartheid and racism and love across the colour bar. And she helped Nelson Mandela write, you know, his famous speech at the treason trial.
It must have been very difficult at that time to be a white person and to be sympathetic to the anti-apartheid movement.
Yes, I think so. She was, in fact, you know, way ahead of her time in many ways, because she reached her hand out to people all around and she became involved with the ANC. And when her philosophy was, you know, even if you didn't agree with all the principles of the ANC, you know, you should join it so that you could make it a better organization. That was basically the philosophy from which she worked.
The African National Congress described her as saying that she has been a party member while it was a banned organization, and said that the country has lost an unmatched literary giant. So she was a member of the African National Congress.
Yes, as I understand it, she was a member of the ANC, and although, you know, she retained her political independence throughout her life, you know, she was always sort of a voice of reason and she was very clear thinking, and she would be critical when she felt it was necessary. And yes, I think South Africa has lost, you know, a literary giant. As you know, she won the Nobel Prize in 1991. You know, I also work at Wits University, and we've had a long association with her. And one of our famous sort of memorial lectures have been the Nadine Gordimer lecture.
I was reading that she did not keep quiet, or even though South Africa got its, what we say, independence, the anti-apartheid movement was successful, but I think she did not keep quiet. She kept also talking about the current system in South Africa.
Yes, she always was critical when she felt that it was necessary to be critical. So although I think she did appreciate the changes that have come about, she didn't keep quiet, as you say. She would speak her mind if she thought that things were not right.
Libby Mitchell is head of the School of Languages and Literature at the University of Witwatersrand. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Our time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigerian Sports Minister Tami Danagogo takes the most important decision of his short tenure as the FIFA deadline to reinstate the duly elected Nigeria Football Federation executive runs out today, Tuesday. FIFA suspended Nigeria from international football last week when a court order culminated in the removal of the duly elected NFF executive. Subsequently, the sports ministry appointed an administrator to run football. According to FIFA, this constitutes government interference. Failure to reinstate the duly elected NFF executive led by Aminu Maigari will lead to huge setbacks for Nigerian teams. Nigerian Falconets will miss the FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup. The Golden Eagles will not defend their FIFA Under-17 World Cup crown. Nigeria Super Falcons will miss the Africa Women's Championship draws on Saturday and thereby miss a chance to qualify for the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup. While the African champions Nigeria Super Eagles are in danger of not defending their hard-won trophy in Morocco next year. On a more cheerful note, a record 14 entries have been drawn for the 40th edition of the Regional Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Kagame Club Cup Championships to be staged in Kigali, Rwanda from the 8th to 24th of August. Burundi's defending champions Vitalo head Group C, which includes Sudan's El Merreikh, Somalia's Benadir and Rwanda's Police. Rwanda's league champions Rayon Sports are seeded in Group A, which also features Tanzania Mainland's Young Africans, Ethiopia's Kofi, South Sudan's Atlabara, and Zanzibar's Kikosi Maalum cha Kuangamiza Magendo. Group B includes Rwanda's military side APR, Uganda's Kampala City Council Authorities, Djibouti's Telkom, Burundi's Flambeau de l'Est, and Kenya's Gor Mahia. Finally, in rugby, hosts Uganda pipped Kenya 15-14 in the first leg of the men's contest at the annual Mount Elgon Cup in Kampala, Uganda on Saturday. Uganda also beat Kenya 15-10 in the under-19 tie, while Kenya outplayed Uganda 33-15 in the women's match. The return leg is set for the Kenyan capital Nairobi on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Listener mail for this Tuesday morning, July 15th.
As a polytechnic student, Department of Public Administration, Akanebe Afara Polytechnic, Ebonyi said, I wish to use your medium to appreciate the newly sworn in Nigerian Minister for Education, Mr. Ibrahim Shakarao, who immediately after his swearing in, he met with Academic Staff Union of Nigeria Polytechnic to end the 11-month-old strike. Honestly, Nigeria Polytechnic students are indeed happy with the decision. Albert Alagbo, reporting on behalf of the Polytechnic students all over. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. That's it for this Tuesday, July 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
Wake, 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 wake. Umaru, wake.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
from